the change has been dramatic. I mean, really, really dramatic. I've watched corporations engage in society in really increasingly meaningful ways.
So I've been in the social impact space for just over 9 years now, not nearly as long as many who have had lifelong careers in philanthropy. And I can see why people are attracted to this space. You will often hear me saying that in this sector, you get to work with the best people at the best brands doing the best work. I like to think that together, we're making capitalism great. But I will admit, the magnitude of change I've seen in my time in this discipline is unlike what I've seen in other disciplines. Social impact leaders have had to adapt to so many external influences, like technological and digital transformation, the rapid evolution of AI, the increasing pressure of environmental concerns and disasters, social and human-driven disasters, more wars and conflicts, social and racial injustice and inequity within communities and across geographic lines. It's also been deeply affected by economic swings and consumer, employee, and investor demographics and expectations, not to mention the proliferation of ESG as a parallel measure alongside financial performance. So there's no doubt that what we are experiencing now is actually just the beginning of a long-term change in the nature of business. It is a whole new world. And if you're part of it, you'll know my next guest. She is Carolyn Berkowitz. Carolyn is the president and CEO of the Association of Corporate Citizen Professionals, known as ACCP. She is a nationally recognized corporate social impact leader who has guided nonprofits, foundations, and Fortune 500 companies to solve for complex social issues and realize their greatest impact. She's been in the field of social impact for more than 3 decades. Carolyn took the reins at ACCP in 2018, growing the field's professional association to a record high of more than 250 companies across more than 20 industries. And lately, she's been on the front lines as backlash brews against recent movements in DEI and ESG. So we're really excited to get the view from her perch. Welcome, Carolyn.
Thank you so much, Sona. It's a thrill to be on your podcast. So thank you for inviting me. And thank you for the thought leadership that you and Benevity put out into the world on these issues. It's outstanding. And you know, I always love talking to you. So this will be fun.
Totally, Carolyn. I am so happy to have you here. So you've been in the CSR for, 2 decades now? And most recently, you've led one of the most, one of the industry's premier associations, ACCP, which we're members of as well. So I'd really just love your perspective on what you've seen as the biggest change in the time that you've worked in this field.
So over the course of my career, the change has been dramatic. I mean, really, really dramatic. I've watched corporations engage in society in really increasingly meaningful ways. So it started when I was early in the field around often being the pet project of the CEO, for example, or the CEO's wife, to being maybe an aloha suite or a soft landing for a pre-retirement executive in the company, to then moving on to more of a PR strategy and a good PR strategy, but solely a PR strategy, to now what is absolutely like a critical, strategic, widely accepted business requirement. And so I think there's a couple of things that are the biggest changes for me. One of them is the integration of the work in the business strategy. So if you think about the ability of companies just to compete, whether it's around talent, whether it's around growth and license to operate kinds of growth. So can we integrate or buy another company? Well, in some industries, it absolutely depends on the regulations and the community impact that you might have. Whether it's climate change or human rights or employee engagement or education and workforce development, all of those things, material social issues to a company, all of those things really are central to the work that this profession does. And they are central to a company's ability to do business, grow, be successful in the marketplace. Not to mention the fact that now it's required by law in so many countries because of the ongoing and increasing regulation. So just the idea that that CSR totally impacts a company's ability to be successful, it's undeniable now. And that it just wasn't that way, along the way. I think the other thing to me that is the most noticeable change is the expectation of stakeholders. And it's not exactly the same, but it's related to what I just said. So think about consumers who, as you mentioned, are far more likely to buy from a company whose values they believe in, or investors who are looking at risks differently now, and also choosing to invest in companies who have a stronger social profile and a stronger ESG profile because companies do better financially in those cases, or employees who say, I won't work there unless, or even governments who say, in order to do business in my state or in my country, or in this industry, you must do these things. That's different. Now it is a complete requirement of those people. So 88% of consumers expect that companies will deliver on engagement with the community and social impact. 90% of investors expect the same thing. And you wouldn't think that investors would be that highest group, but they are. And more than 70% of employees won't even consider working for a company that doesn't create meaningful societal impact. So, those things are vastly different. So we may all think that 30 years in or around CSR, feels like forever, but to me, it's a flash in time if you think about the fact that the very fundamental purpose of business and the expectations of corporations has completely transformed in such a short period of time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, what you're talking a lot about is like the tailwinds, right? Like there's just been, both from a regulatory and compliance perspective, which definitely gets the attention of many companies, but also from the imperative and the commercials, the commercial and moral imperatives, yeah, side of things. And so with that is it's exciting for social impact leaders within companies because now they're front and center. But a few weeks ago, we caught up for a virtual coffee, and I heard you describe these past few years specifically, and perhaps euphemistically, Carolyn, as rough. So I'd love to hear, I'd love for you to share with our listeners about why it's been particularly hard lately for impact leaders.
So just keeping up with the speed of change that both you and I just talked about. I mean, AI and technology and social issues and geopolitical issues and the economy, like all of these things are just one after another after another after another creating change. And that in itself is hard to keep up with. And the hot issues really change the whole way of going about the work differently. So take diversity, equity, and inclusion, which in 2020, following the murder of George Floyd, became an imperative, and companies beefed up in all of that. And they made long-term commitments, which they've been fulfilling over the course of the few years. And then the U.S. Supreme Court has a ruling on affirmative action, which is in some ways still being interpreted. At least in terms of business, and it's completely changed. And so now companies don't know whether to even say those words. That kind of thing causes whiplash that is really difficult. You spend, your heart, your soul, your time, your energy creating this magnificent program that differentially invests in people of color, for example, and all of a sudden you can't do that anymore without feeling like there's a target on your back. So I think just that, the hot issues and the speed of change is a huge one. I think another one is the sense that the resources are just fluctuating, So they go up, they go down, they go up, they go down, and they're pretty dramatically changing year over year over year. But the demand is just straight up. So over the last 3 years, budget and headcount went way up, then way down, and now they're sort of relatively flat, while the expectations of the function has only gone up, which is hard. I mean, that is sort of the definition of rough, because you're still expected to do those same things with the resources that you need to do that work, you know, changing right in front of your eyes. Many of our colleagues lost their jobs last year at the same time that 81% of CSR departments took on new responsibilities. So that is really, it's difficult. And now we saw this year that companies are restructuring their functions. There's a lot of leadership transitions, which it in some ways is natural. It's a function of changing generations in the workforce, but there are those leadership transitions. So the demand to prove impact of the work, all of those things are increasing. And the ability to be effective without stability in the resources that you have is just rough. I think the third thing that has made it really difficult is, and you'll understand this pretty probably on a gut level very easily, serving people and being eye to eye with crisis and toll on the human existence, it's very hard, it's emotionally taxing anyway, and it always has been. The last few years, that crisis has just been compounding. So, you know, think about since 2020, the pandemic, racism, the increase of violence, the eroding mental health of young people, of all people, and sort of that existential impact of climate change, they're all upped significantly. And we're on the front lines of these issues for companies. And it's difficult because we have to both have a fast response, right? You've got to respond to this really quickly. You've got to advise us on what our company has to do really quickly. And it has to be a good response. You mean you invested in this organization and you found out later that they do X, Y, or Z? So it's a ton of work every time a crisis occurs. And then when you magnify it, like there's one and then there's another and then there's another, like what about us? We feel all these same things too. We can't take a break. We can't, you know, sort of take care of ourselves during all this. And that, you know, all of these things happening at once, all three of those things is just, it's a lot.
Yeah, you know, the word that was coming to mind as you were speaking, Carolyn, is pressure, right? Like the intense pressure to execute quickly and perfectly, to be honest, right? Like you gotta execute on these really like complex, nuanced, sometimes like historically embedded conflicts and issues and come out and do it perfectly in record time. And the pressure of that is intense. Right. And I think
and
these
then
are people.
Do it, you know, the pandemic and, you know, in a horrible moment of police brutality and you know, questioning our fundamental views on race. Like, okay, so now we got to do that and that and that and that. And it is a pressure cooker. And nobody, you know, we're thinking about everybody else.
Yeah, exactly. I hear so many professionals saying that, like, they're carrying the weight of the world. You know, who is carrying them? And I think, you know, you've done such a beautiful job of painting the picture for other business leaders who may not quite appreciate the level of challenge that social impact and leaders and businesses are actually contending with and have been for the last number of years. And, you know, you kind of touched on this, the whiplash that they're experiencing. And I know you've seen some of our data on the tension between companies acting courageously or cautiously. So we showed in our latest State of Corporate Purpose report that caution is now outpacing courage threefold when leaders have to make a choice about being vocal or activating on a hot button issue. And so more are playing it safe and staying on the sidelines, and fewer kind of sticking their necks out and making bigger statements. And I can't help but wonder if that's correlated to the increase in mental health, because they're not, you know, having to get it perfect in a public way. But I'd just love to hear like what you're seeing around this trend of caution and courage.
I ultimately think at the root cause is the political divisiveness and everything being politicized. So, you know, 10 years ago, even, it was not necessarily a political thing to talk about stemming political violence. It was just an of course thing. And now it's everything is tinged with you're taking a side. And so speaking out on issues leads to a larger assumption that you're a blue company or a red company. And that's alienating. At the same time, 70% of CEOs last year felt it was their role to speak out publicly on divisive social issues. And 77% of consumers wanted companies to speak out on those same issues. But then there was a drop. So it's the employees that believe that their companies should only speak out when it's related to their core function. So I think the change will likely be around that. How does it relate to the core function? So there's one example that I use all the time. It's a life insurance company. And they are very outspoken about their support for gun control. So they publicly speak on the issue. They've signed documents. They affiliate with coalitions to prevent gun violence. And if you think about the fact that gun violence is the leading cause of death in this young adult age group, or one of the leading causes of death, I don't want to misspeak, stemming gun violence is actually fundamental to their bottom line and to their business. So it makes sense for them to do that. And I think when companies are as clear as that, it's easier for them to speak up than when it isn't quite clear. And I hope that changes. I hope more companies can act on their values. But, you know, as we've seen, there's a real fear. So not just a fear of backlash on business, but there's a fear of like threats on people's lives. So it's, you know, the stakes are kind of high when you think about who you're putting at risk by talking about something that is perceived as political.
Yeah, I mean, that's talk about pressure, right? I think what's really interesting about what you just said and kind of tying it back to the last part of our conversation is that as this discipline, you know, corporate social responsibility or social impact becomes more strategic, the more aligned to the business's core values and functions it becomes. And so I think that's super logical. You know, but we are still finding like corporate citizenship professionals in the hot seat with all this DEI and ESG backlash and, you know, the anti-woke movement more generally. And I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about how this might have affected their work.
It does affect their work. But the good news is it hasn't fundamentally changed their work, or at least that's the response that we got to our most recent CSR Insights survey, which I'd encourage folks download from our website, accp.org, and under resources, you can find that. But the survey showed that 90% of companies, for example, have remained consistent with their DEI programming, which is great. What has changed is the language they use, and that's changed pretty dramatically. What's also changed is the oversight, both legal and compliance-related oversight. So corporate lawyers are looking at everything we say to be sure that. And companies are finding unique ways to describe their commitments without using specific language. We saw recently the Society for Human Resources Management now inclusion and belonging, which, you know, I am not a big fan of taking out the word equity, But what really matters is what a company does, not necessarily what a company calls it. I have I don't know whether it's a funny example or not a funny example, but one company we work with that is international and has a pretty broad presence in the US, also a tech company, published a 50 plus page guide or document on what language to use. So the words you can say, the words you can't say, in which cultures, with which audiences, in what countries. It's like 50 pages worth of it. So it's, you know, it's some serious business on how carefully people are treating it. But ESG it's sort of the same thing with the ESG backlash. But the truth of the matter is that it's required for doing business in so many places. And while they may be, many are unclear about what the regulations will mean in the US because they're in a stay right now, half of them are already collecting data for scope 1 and 2. And of those, then another 20% are already collecting scope 3. So they're doing the work that they have to do. They're just talking about it differently and internally being managed differently.
Yeah, that totally echoes the data we have, Carolyn, which said that 62% of impact leaders are continuing the work of ESG, just not calling it that, whether it's sustainability or, you know, whatever it might be. That 50-page guide sounds like it could be very useful to people.
I know it could be useful to people, but it's, you know, it's very specific to this company. And I was sort of floored when she told me that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it just goes to show the complexity, right? Because you're triangulating regulatory compliance, cultural nuances, even like keywords in social media that can get you reported, like, or you're, you know, deprioritized in algorithms. Like, there's a lot to consider.
Yeah. Yeah. The Congressional Black Caucus recently asked U.S. companies of a certain size to report on the commitments that they made and how they're doing with them, and, you know, and then their HR data, et cetera, that's related to race, gender, et cetera. And it wasn't clear what was going to be done with the data. So it's like, if you do report on it, it was voluntary. If you do report on it, then who's going to take it and put a target on your back? If you don't report on it, you know, what will be said about you in terms of being fearful of or losing your commitment to? So in some ways, it's a no-win. And I think, you know, employees are choosing with their feet. 95% of employees weigh a prospective employer's DEI efforts when choosing between job offers. Like, that's a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not a stat you can ignore.
Right.
Totally.
And right.
Kind of digging in on this concept of all the crises and disasters, we touched on that earlier. I wanted to just come back to that because Global Giving, another great partner in our space, said that crises are up 10 times in frequency and severity since the 1960s. And so I'm also curious about that, Carolyn. Like, how has that changed, you know, the day-to-day job and strategy of social impact professionals? And if you can speak to how that's changed the business at large, I'd love to hear your perspective.
So I hadn't heard that stat, but it doesn't really surprise me. And, you know, all the reasons that we've talked about, you know, whether it's climate change or racial relations or violence, like, the field needs to be prepared for the onslaught of this at any time. And I think one big difference is that they are prepared. So, you know, they are budgeting for crisis, both in their regular budgets for CSR and in, you know, the just in case fund in the office of the CEO or someplace else. And I think we might never get used to it, but in some ways we're much more prepared for it. I've seen that it is a whole person's job, or two people or three people, disaster and disaster response, which That's a new role. When I left the field just 8 years ago and came here, when I left a company, I should say, there wasn't somebody whose job specifically was disaster response. And I had a department of 36, which, you know, now there's in every company, large or small. I think companies are being smart about it. So disaster playbooks are much more frequent now. Companies are creating these playbooks that they're doing it at a time when nothing is happening, when they can think about it, and they're collaborating and getting buy-in from around the company. And it's responses, you know, what do I do in this situation? How do I prioritize among these situations? And so I think it considers the impact on employees and customers and their publics. So I think the most important thing for companies is, you know, impacting the health and well-being and safety of their own employees. And then, you know, there's considerations of geography and where associates are located and, you know, business's reputation or presence in a given community and the impact of the disaster in that community, whether access is to services or to technology, et cetera, is impacted. Business continuity, you know, connectivity, the needs of families. So, you know, what's happening in schools or what's happening in this other country where this disaster occurred that, you know, 8% of our employees are from this country. All of those then get worked out in advance so that the decisions become easier and they can act much more quickly. I think that's smart. You called them social and what did you call man-made, person-made disasters?
Human-driven disasters.
Yeah, human-driven disaster. That's harder to sort of have a playbook for because they're all so different. So we've had lots of calls with members on what could a playbook look like. And we're working with peer organizations to develop something, but it's not quite as clear what that means because it gets back to the issue of speaking out on some social issues. You know, think about Israel and Hamas. That was a very, very difficult thing for companies, no matter what they said. Nobody thought it was good. So that it, you know, and who to support and how to support it gets kind of messy. I think the other thing that is interesting that is now pretty commonplace is you have your disaster partners. So you know, like somebody like the Red Cross, you fund them X hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, and you are automatically included in any response to any disaster. And so, you know, when we think about spending on the budgets, you know, you can't, if you don't spend what you've got, you lose it the next year. So that's one of the ways that companies are doing that, or the United Way has some similar things. Or if you think about global giving, you mentioned global giving in this, like global giving has local partners on the ground everywhere. And so immediately they have this network of professionals and organizations who are local, who are close to the people, who know what needs to be done, who are, you know, sort of talking to those who are impacted and in knowing that they will be there for you and in supporting them. So I think it has changed the field dramatically, and it's not going to end. It's going to keep on going. And I think the more we can sort of prepare during calmer times for those things and develop our own playbooks, the better we will be able to respond.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like what you're describing is a maturation.
It's a maturation of the problem and a maturation of the solution. Both.
Yeah, that's a great way of saying it. So we've talked a lot about disasters. You know, many CSR practitioners are very worried about the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling on affirmative action, which you referred to earlier. I wanted to come back to this. So can you talk a little bit about the regulations, how they're changing, and like how this is actually changing the work of people in this space?
I am not a legal expert, so this will be in layperson's terms, both as a citizen and as somebody who's talked to a lot of businesses about this. But what the Supreme Court actually weighed in on was favoring certain, by race, by gender, certain communities, individuals, ethnicities, etc., and saying that something is only available to this group, but it's not available to the broader group. And that was specifically in education. So you can't, you know, only give scholarships to this group or that group. You can't only allow people into your college or university or classroom from these groups. And it completely upends the notion that as a country, we are built on the backs of slaves, frankly, who have a whole lot less social standing generation by generation by generation, have been kept out of things, redlining, et cetera. And so what affirmative action did was offer this opportunity to sort of jump ahead to recognize that we weren't starting at the same starting gate. And so what the Supreme Court did is made that illegal with and actually calling it racist. So that's a difficult thing for many to contend with. But what they did not do is talk about DEI in business per se. However, there are lots of lawsuits out there right now with companies who are setting targets around hiring or targets around leadership in the organization, saying we want X percentage of all directors to be of color, to be, you know, either gender neutral or women to be. So there are lots of challenges around sort of what they might call quotas. Companies are scared. The same idea of legal oversight, language change, you know, is very real. But right this minute, it is not, the Supreme Court has not ruled on how this impacts business per se. It's really in education. So it's a wait and see. It's how is the field reacting? It's pretty devastating. But again, it's sort of something becoming political. And it's, you know, politically motivated, and the lawsuits are coming from, you know, some who have deep political feelings about that. And so, you know, they're spending lots of money to sue companies to do that. And so we will see. I think what's difficult about it is the fear that it incites and the freeze that companies are feeling like they have to follow.
Well, yeah, a lot is hanging in the balance, right? And I think what people may not appreciate, and it's so obvious, is that the work of philanthropy is the work of inequity. It is removing inequity.
Right.
So I think it's kind of existential for, you know, people in this space. Exactly. We're like, well, that's the entire aim of our work. Is it becoming illegal? Like, that's really disconcerting.
Right. I mean, how do we create community and economic change and well-being if we can't disaggregate the data and understand where the impact is the greatest and who needs these things the most?
Yeah.
And so it is the antithesis. You are exactly right of what we're here for. But if you get creative, you get around it, you know, it's open to everybody. Some people say, but first, you know, first generation college goers, or like there are some things you can do or say that are not quite as as targeted or blatant. But we'll see.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting. But I think to your point, there are companies who are building what I would say kind of risk-proof messaging, and the way they're designing their programs, they know they're going to attract people with the greatest need, but without putting a target on their own backs.
Yeah.
So you're right. Yeah. I love, this is what I love about you, Carolyn. You're always like, don't stop the work, just find another way to do it.
Find a way around. And that, that takes creativity. It takes nuance. It takes expertise. It takes being able to sort of be bilingual, to work very closely and naturally in community, and to work closely and naturally with senior leaders, finance folks, et cetera. So it's like all of those things, this is our moment. Like, we've been trained for a reason.
Yeah, exactly. So I want to talk a bit about your legacy at ACCP, because you did announce your retirement. In the time that I've worked with you, you have championed such a big focus on diversity in the philanthropic space. Also collaboration. Carolyn, I would say that you broke down barriers that used to exist in this space from a collaboration point of view and cooperation point of view. So, ACCP is just such a strong voice on the role of diversity in CSR collaboration. Like, you've really modeled it. I'd love to talk a little bit about why that was important to you, but also what do you, from a legacy perspective, hope for the industry as you move into retirement?
On the issue of diversity and having an inclusive field, our field has done this for so many other fields. So if you think about, it's sort of like the shoemaker's son wearing shoes with holes in them. If we think about the efforts that we've made to diversify technology, for example, and investing in tech and, sort of diversifying tech and women in tech and LGBTQ tech and, people of color in tech and preparing them for jobs or engineering or, there's so many fields that we have taken a huge role in to build our own workforces as a company, but we haven't done it for ourselves. And so we did this research in 2021 that said that the field is primarily white women, and no field is going to be successful if it only has a homogenous group of professionals in it. So we need lived experience as we think about, how we are impacting society and how we are impacting communities. We need people that are part of the very communities that we seek to serve. We need people who think differently than we do wherever we are. We need people that are not necessarily traditional corporate ladder climbing folks. And so I think both for our profession to be all it can be, to offer this opportunity. I mean, in some ways, it's such a privilege of a job, even though we've talked about how hard it is. It's also, you know, the fact that you put your head on the pillow every night and you've worked really hard, but it's in service to society and to making the world better. Like, that is a huge opportunity for all. And then the outcomes of whatever we do will be so much better when we are inclusive of all. So I've long believed that this is a really important issue. And so far, it takes a generation to change industries and fields and especially working in complex systems with resource challenges, et cetera. So what we have done is we've collected data every year on the composition of the field, and we've seen it is not changing at the top as quickly as it could. So, the head of the department is it fluctuates. It's not necessarily getting more diverse. But the ranks inside are actually the the percentage of companies that have fewer than 25% of their staff of color has gone way down. Fewer or no people of color working on their teams. And the group that is above 20%, more than 25%, more than 50% even, has gone way up. So we're seeing some movement, and I think that that's important. So there's collecting the data that's really important. There's also creating a pipeline and preparing this generation of leaders of color and talent for to step into those roles as people like me retire. And then I think being a place where everybody feels comfortable coming to ACC, people seeing to ACCP, I'm sorry, seeing that they, you know, there are people like me here. So being that welcoming, diverse organization, all of those things are concrete things that we can do and keep doing that would change the field. I know you asked me about sort of the legacy too, which I need to, my head needs to shift a little bit, but I think the value that we bring and the recognized necessity of social impact work on the success of a company, that's been a big change. I think the resources and the stability of resources absolutely needs to follow that. So 7 years from now or 10 years from now, I hope my successor will say, you know, we budgets are going up or budgets have gone up X percent. The size of staff is different. It's bigger. I think the recognition of CEOs that this really is necessary enough to resource, but also a nuanced, eclectic, challenging position that requires, you know, real understanding, deep understanding of these different systems, and therefore they're willing to pay for it, is absolutely something that I really hope to see. And I think overall, more companies doing this work and doing it better and being able to demonstrate that they, you know, that it's having an impact, I think will be enormous. I had a CFO who I been a mentor forever, but when I worked in a big corporation, and he used to say to me, I could buy risk management and I can buy employee engagement and I can buy, you know, advertising or reputation, but if you and the function that you represent or compliance, in this case I was at a bank, but the role of CSR does all of those things for the same dollar, right? So he would always say it, the investment in this function is absolutely the, you know, a no-brainer. It is so much less than what I would pay for each of these things that we simply have to do anyway. And so I think if more CFOs would really understand that, then I think our path will be paved for the long run.
Well, and I think, Carolyn, I don't think I'm overstating this. I think anyone who's had the opportunity to spend time with you, see what ACCP has done and the reports you have published, the data that you've published, the enablement you've brought to the sector, people would say you have equipped them single-handedly to go and advocate more effectively for more investment because this is strategic to business going forward. And this is a long-term investment. And it's a high ROI investment because it doesn't actually cost a lot to do all of that.
It's so cheap. How can they think that cutting this is wise? You know, like of all the things that you could do, it just makes no sense to me. But that story, we all need to be able to tell that story as easily as my CFO could do it.
Well, thank you, Carolyn. I think you've enabled a lot of us to tell that story. And I think what's been really special for me about today is being able to have this conversation, but I think painting the picture for the executives who sit alongside the people who lead impact to have empathy, understanding of the value, and to be able to support it. Because unless it becomes business-wide or enterprise-wide, It will never achieve its full potential. So thank you for joining us today. Best of luck in your transition into retirement. Wish you all the best. And hopefully when you put your head down on the pillow, you can see that over your 3-decade career, you have made a significant impact on our industry and me as well, and our space. So thank you.
Thank you, Sona.